This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll hear from veteran economist Lauren Scott, the former chair of the LSU Economics Department. He will assess the impact of a trade war on the Louisiana economy. Also, Columbia University economic historian Adam Tooze, on his book Crashed, it details the 10th anniversary of the 2008 financial crisis and what has happened since. The country, obviously, is still recovering from what happened a decade ago. Alexandria media personality, radio talk show host Tony Brown will comment on the documentary Sugartown, the story of a young black man's suspicious death in police custody in New Iberia. Victor White III died on March 3rd, 2014, and the family reached out to Tony Brown. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. You can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Dr. Lauren Scott. He is president of Lauren C. Scott & Associates, a 35-year-old firm providing economic consulting, but most remember him well as the chair of the economics department at LSU from 1983 to 1996. And during that time, his department rose to number 38 in the nation among universities for teaching economics. Dr. Scott taught at the Old War School for 30 years. 877-217-5757 and 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. We're going to move along and hit some matters of importance for a man who follows the economy with earnest. And chemicals, which amount to Louisiana's third largest export to China, a major industry in the state, were targeted last week in a $60 billion list of potential U.S. goods that China put in the crosshairs of a trade dispute with the president. China's finance ministry accused the administration of damaging the global economy, and soybeans, Louisiana's top export to China, at almost $6 billion, a crop that's farmed on 1 million acres in the state, have already been hit with heavy tariffs and retaliation to U.S. duties imposed on China earlier this year. What's your take, Dr. Scott?
Well, it's very concerning. I'm actually in the middle of writing the Louisiana Economic Outlook, and it's tough when you have this going on right now because we have about, just on the chemical side alone, about $92 billion in plants that have announced that they want to build in Louisiana but haven't started going vertical yet. And these tariffs have hurt the prospects in two ways. Number one, it's increased the cost of building their plants. And these are very capital-intensive, very steel-intensive plants, and I think it was one plant that I looked at that was going to cause their cost to go up somewhere in the neighborhood of $95 million, and this is not one of the bigger ones. This is one of the smaller ones. And then the second thing is that China has retaliated and said, well, we're going to put a tax on your LNG exports and your methanol that you produce over there. Well, once again, a number of these plants are LNG potential plants or LNG export plants or methanol producers, and so they've got two things going against them now. They've got an increase in their cost, and now they've got a problem that they have a decrease in demand because their price is being pushed up by these tariffs. So this makes it tougher for them to raise money in the financial market. And, you know, we have a lot at stake. $90 billion is a lot of construction activity for our state.
And with our heavy port activity in Louisiana, we have some of the world's most busy ports. That will be affected as well, I would think.
And that's right, especially the port of New Orleans, which is one of the major importers of steel. They handle a lot of steel down there. So it's already been an issue for them. And then, of course, this $90 billion worth of activity is all located on either the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, or it's located over in Lake Charles along the Lake Charles Ship Channel, which, again, is where our ports are located. And they're all sitting there hoping for a big increase in activity, and now that's been put in a little bit of jeopardy. I think the great hope out there is that this is all just a negotiating gambit on the part of the president to try to get China to the table and stop with their intellectual property, basically intellectual property theft, instead of being just protectionism. If it's protectionism, then we're in for a lot more trouble than just losing these $90 billion in projects.
877-217-5757 to talk with Dr. Lauren Scott, who will be with us for a couple of segments today. And he is a man who follows not only the state economy, but the national and world economy. And as we've heard him through the years, he's a card-carrying conservative. And I would suspect there are probably aspects of the Trump economic plan that you like a lot. But does this blip negate the good things that you see in his strategy?
Well, I mean, the good things are the deregulation and the lower tax rates. Both of those are very pro-growth, and we're already seeing the numbers in real gross domestic product going up over what they were during the Obama years because of those two things. The difficult thing out there, and I've been pretty upfront about this, is that these tariffs, if this turns into an all-out trade war, will more than offset those good things. I mean, it would be very easy for us to slip into a recession far worse than the great recession that we experienced in 08 and 09. I mean, trade wars can end up being very, very, very bad. And you're already seeing all kinds of anecdotal evidence across the United States where companies are, you know, they can't get cheaper steel and cheaper aluminum and for canning vegetables and things like that. They're having to lay people off, or their costs are going up markedly. It's just creating all kinds of difficulties across the United States. And if this escalates, you know, every time we increase our tariff, somebody else is going to increase theirs on one of our products. And it's a lose-lose game. There's no way to win from this. So hopefully, again, it's just a negotiating gambit against China. We'll just see how this all pans out. Makes it hard to forecast the Louisiana economy for the next couple of years, I promise you that.
Why do you think the president is doing it?
Well, if you look at what is going on with China, if you look at our trading partners in the North American Free Trade Agreement, we import maybe 4% more from Canada than we sell from them. We import about 28% more from Mexico than we sell from them. And most of that's automobile parts. If you took automobile parts out, we actually have a surplus in Mexico. The problem is China. We import four times more from China than they sell to us. And behind this really is the way China is handling their trade with our companies. They are handling their trade with our companies in a way that enables them to essentially get our intellectual property. And that has been the real, real issue here. And, you know, hopefully what this will do will get China to the table and have them saying, okay, we'll revise the way we deal in international trade with the intellectual property issue, and we'll be back on the right track again. And one indication, Jim, that this is a negotiating gambit is the fact that when these tariffs were initially levied, they were levied on everybody, and the head of the EU came over here, had a meeting with the president, and now they're talking about lowering tariffs across the board, so which would suggest that the negotiating gambit worked with them. Maybe it'll work with China. But if it doesn't, if this turns out to be just, hey, we're going to protect our domestic industries, I promise you we're going to end up way worse off. This is one of the few things in which all economists virtually agree.
All right, 877-217-5757 is your number, and talk@talklouisiana.org is your email. And a listener, Ben, in Spanish Town, notes that even though the economy is moving very nicely right now, the deficit is now projected at $1 trillion for the year. Does that matter? In the past, you've said deficits really don't matter that much. What about a $1 trillion deficit for 1 year?
Well, I mean, we didn't worry about it. Well, I don't know what side of the political spectrum your caller was on, but that didn't seem to be a problem when Obamacare was passed, which created actually more than a $1 trillion deficit, as it turns out. I mean, I don't think it's an overwhelmingly bad thing right now. It's very unnerving, But if you look at the forecast out there for what's expected to happen to the national economy, if you want a free forecast, and a very good one, by the way, go to www.wellsfargo.com and go to their econ department, and you'll see that they are, despite the deficit that we're talking about here, they're still forecasting a fairly robust second half of this year and a pretty good 2019.
All right, hold tight. 877-217-5757. We're going to start going to the phone lines. There is a line open if you'd like to join us. And a listener does note that the deficit that President Trump is going to have will exceed by a good margin, almost double the last deficit of President Obama. Leonard in Lafayette. Hi, Leonard. Good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. I'm glad to see that you understand that goring your own ox is bad for you, and perhaps in time you will understand that goring the other man's ox is bad for them. You're wrong in thinking that Obama didn't do a good job economically. You forget that he brought us out of an incredible recession.
All right. Dr. Scott, your response to Leonard?
I missed the last part of his sentence. I mean, let me explain to you. We did have a very, matter of fact, we're in the midst of a very long growth period right now. We're about to exceed, I think, 110 months, which is about the second longest in our history. But if you look back at the Obama years, it was a very, and you compare the growth in real gross domestic product in the Obama years to any recovery that we went through since World War II, it was the worst ever. It averaged 2.1% growth in real gross domestic product, which is about what Europe does. Okay.
All right. We do have to pause, but we'll be back in 90 seconds with more from Dr. Lauren Scott. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And Allie Baltazar is producing. We're discussing the national and world and state economy with Dr. Lauren Scott, the well-known and well-versed economist from a conservative slant here in Baton Rouge. Brenda in White Oak. Brenda, good morning. You're on with Dr. Scott.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Dr. Scott. Dr. Scott, you keep saying that we'll be okay if the president is using this as a negotiating tactic. How long can we use this as a negotiating tactic before it starts to harm us?
Well, I think it's a very good question. And, I mean, my rough guess would be that if this doesn't start working out by about the first quarter of 2019, then you're going to start seeing impacts on real gross domestic product. There's just too much distortion and disruption being created right now for this not to ultimately impact our real gross domestic product. So I'm expecting maybe sometime around the first quarter of 2019. I don't think it's very far off.
Marie in Eunice. Hi, Marie. You're on the air on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Lauren Scott.
Hi. Thanks, Jim, and thanks, Mr. Scott, Dr. Scott.
Sure.
I guess my concern is why must Louisiana's economy pay the price for the failures that are in the intellectual property sector? Why must our farmers and our oil and gas folks be docked as they're being all docked and suffering when, in fact, our products should be negotiated independently of intellectual property issues?
Yeah, well, that's the problem with trade issues like this, trade wars, is that there's no discrimination in terms of the pain. And the reason for that is because the president has the power to levy tariffs on specific items that China that sells us, but he has no control over how China retaliates. And the way China's retaliated is China's retaliated so that there will be pain all over the place. That's part of the negotiating gambit. And so Louisiana is having to pay in many different industries for the attempt to try to bring China to the table. The president has no control over that, but, well, he has control, but he could have not started this in the first place. But he has no control over how China is going to pick out which products and services they decide to retaliate with. And it just happened to fall on us, as it turns out, as well as other places in the United States, too.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Scott in our remaining time with him. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on the air with Dr. Scott. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. First, let me dispel a big lie that's been told many times. When the Republicans took control of the Congress in 1994, we had the greatest economy of all time under President Clinton. And the Republicans say it was because the Republicans reduced spending. Well, that's a lie. I went to the Almanac and studied the budget. If you subtract interest on the debt...
How is that applicable to today?
Well, I'm getting to the tax cuts.
Go ahead.
Okay. If you subtract interest on the debt, which nobody can control, the increase in the rate of spending went up under the Republicans. And when President Reagan cut taxes, we tripled the national debt. When President Clinton increased taxes, we had the best economy of all time. We had more growth under President Clinton. We reduced the deficit every year. We reduced unemployment every year.
All right, Dr. Scott. Even Bob Livingston was on this show 2 days ago talking about what he called Bill Clinton a good president, largely based on the economy. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think you need to take Bill Clinton's administration, which was not a bad administration. He was responsible for NAFTA. I mean, NAFTA, from a trade standpoint, that was a great move on his part. It's the kind of thing you'd expect out of a Republican presidency, and it came out of a Democratic. But that was very good. I think you have to break his presidency up into two parts. I think you have to break it up into part pre-tax increase and post-tax increase. I think if you look at post-tax increase period, that was the period that led us right into the recession that followed right after that. So I think it really depends. Now, as I mentioned to Jim, the Republicans have to answer for the fact that under President Bush, they allowed spending to go straight up when they had both the presidency and the House and the Senate. They let a kink occur in federal government spending that they need to answer for.
All right, Rinaldi in North Baton Rouge. Hi, Rinaldi. You're on with Dr. Lauren Scott.
Dr. Scott, big time fan, but it just makes my blood boil when I hear people like you say that under President Obama we had the slowest recovery. Now, Dr. Scott, let's try and be at least intellectually honest and say, under the previous recessions, did the government have to come up with TARP and bail out General Motors and the rest of these different things? In other words, the Obama recession period was far, far worse than the recession that came in the two previous recessions before that under President Bush and the one that was under President Reagan. So I want you to be at least fair and honest to say, in other words, this country, how close, Dr. Scott, did we come to financial collapse?
All right. Did we nearly have a financial collapse of it was catastrophic as it was, but could it have been even more cataclysmic?
No, it could have been more cataclysmic. And let me make sure that I'm being very clear. I'm talking about the period after the recession. We're talking about the recovery period from 2010 forward to the end of his presidency, not including the period that had the recession in it. Again, if you look at the period, I'm talking about comparing recoveries to recoveries coming out of all the different ones that we've had since World War II. And you cannot, as an economist, I argue, you cannot blame the slow growth on the depth of the recession. I think you blame the slow growth on the regulatory tsunami that came out. Just look at the number of pages in the Federal Registry, if it'll help you to document that. And if you look at the emphasis on raising taxes rather than decreasing taxes, these are tsunami regulations and very high emphasis on tax increases is something that is anti-growth. And when you get anti-growth, you get slow growth rates, and that's exactly what we got during that time period.
Silas Bogue writes, when are the members of the selection committee for the Nobel Peace Prize for Economics going to come to their senses and recognize the path-breaking work of LSU Emeritus Professor Dr. Lauren Scott?
I love it. What a nice present for the day.
Okay. Miriam Davey writes, trade war from the president is already hurting average Americans. We thought we were never going to get our new porch lights to come in. Had to order three different times from three different stores, and we already paid for the general contractor for installation. That was in May. It's now August. We have an entire house to floor. We're having trouble getting a price estimate on the tile portion. And then she goes on and from there, but apparently believing that this is related to the current economic conditions.
Well, I think she's probably right on target on part of that. I mean, I don't know what extent it's that versus Jim, the fact that there is a looming and growing labor shortage in the especially in the home construction area. There have been a number of articles coming out where the new group of young people coming out are not interested in this industry, do not want to work outside and do that kind of work. And so contractors are having a really tough time getting people. But I suspect that much of our stuff is associated with this trade issue. It is a non-trivial and very disruptive problem.
All right. Steve in Sorrento, we want to slide you in before we part company with Dr. Scott. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. How y'all doing?
Fine.
How you doing, Jim? How you doing?
Fine.
I'm Scott.
What's your question?
Scott, I want to know something. Okay, you said NAFTA was good under Clinton, President Clinton. And from my understanding, President Trump wanted to get rid of NAFTA.
All right, that is true. In that case, I would say you would side over the former president, 42, over the current one, 45. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we're joined for this segment by media personality and talk show host who is a big player in the politics of central Louisiana, Tony Brown, who's been with us before, and he is involved in a peripheral way in this documentary, Sugar Town. It's about the Victor White III death case and the family's crusade for justice for what happened 4 years ago in New Iberia. And good morning to you, Tony Brown.
Hey, Jim. Good morning. No disrespect. Let me just go ahead and give you my real title. I am a professional broadcast journalist who have worked for the past 30 years in both television and radio. So I am a journalist by profession who happens to own a radio station, who happens to have a statewide talk show. So thank you for having me.
All right. It's a pleasure to talk with you. What about the death case of Victor White III and the Discovery documentary Sugar Town? You're involved, as I said, in a way. What are your thoughts about where this stands at this point?
Well, I mean, the Sugar Town aired. It debuted on Monday, is my understanding, and it's been critically acclaimed. We happen to be at the Television Critics Association week before last at their national meeting there in Beverly Hills in Los Angeles, and a group of journalists like myself from all over the country, People Magazine, TV Guide, Dish, many bloggers, professional journalists, to the tune of hundreds, watched the film, screened it. And afterwards, I was really surprised by their reaction. It got a standing ovation, not only for my work in actually breaking that story, along with many other high-profile cases here in Louisiana, but also for Victor White and just his stick-to-itiveness. That's Pastor White, the father of Victor White III, who have been steadfastly for the past 4.5 years, along with us, telling this story wherever he's invited, wherever there's a protest, and wherever people will listen to him. I think the movie is going to be critically acclaimed. I think it's been well received. I think the identification, investigation, discovery of the ID channel did a wonderful job. They felt it was a story that had to be told, and not only here in Louisiana, which is not getting a whole lot of PR, but I tell you what, outside of Louisiana, from New York to L.A., people have received the film, and they're as shocked as many of us are when we start looking at the facts of this case surrounding
the controversy.
Well,
let's get to that. What are the facts?
Well, the facts is you got a sheriff that's been there for 10 years, Lewis Ackle. The fact of the matter is that 9 people have died in custody deaths while he has been sheriff there in New Iberia. The fact that he's had to pay out of the sheriff's fund more than $3 million in settlements for police brutality and excessive force. The fact that we have video in the jail showing dogs being attacking inmates who are being submissive and listening to commands. You have at least 10 of his officers, as you and I speak this morning, 9 of which are in jail, serving either 3 months to 7 years. They return federal state evidence against him, and of course, Cattle Parish jury exonerated him, but the officers who told the truth, and I believe they told the truth, certainly trying to save themselves, told that they were trained by this sheriff how to violate particularly black people's civil rights. You know, when you have a sheriff that directs his officers to go into the black neighborhood and do what he calls, quote, excuse my French, nigger knocking, that's problematic. When you have a sheriff that has a family member who gets into an argument with a private citizen, and then you send two deputies in plain clothes to that person's house, and they beat this person up. Jim, I don't care how you slice it up. That's lawlessness.
All right.
That's not police officers. That's a gang.
What happened to Victor White?
4.5 years ago, on March 3rd of 2014, Victor White was walking to the Hop-In store along with his friend Isaiah Lewis. They went into the store to buy a cigar. While they were in the store, they saw two African-American men outside the store fighting. And, of course, you and I know when anybody is disrupting or disturbing the peace, somebody's going to call the police. And someone did. So they exited the store the way that they came in, going back to that domicile about a mile, about a block or two away. And the two guys who were actually fighting went the other way. So presumably the cops stopped them in the probable cause that they were the suspects who were doing the fighting. And they clearly told the officer, you know, we weren't involved in a fight. When you go back and you look at the videotape evidence and you go back and you look at the clothes that they were wearing, according to the 911 call, completely different clothing, completely different description of the suspect. So once the officer had admitted on tape that he was confident that they were not the ones involved in the fight, all bets should have been off. He should have let them go. He didn't have proper authority or probable cause to seize them because the search and the seizure of him was illegal. But let's say he let Isaiah Lewis go. He searched Victor White III twice, he says, under oath in federal court testimony, and he was able to retrieve from searching twice a small bag or a dime bag of marijuana. With that case, he could have written this kid a ticket or whatever the case may be. But what they were trying to do is to get him to turn state's evidence or to give up whoever he bought the weed from or whatever the case may be. So after searching this kid, they put him in the back of a squad car. And it took them, from the time he went into the squad car, 3 hours to get to the jail. And when they get to the jail, they park in an inconspicuous spot, a blind spot, if you will, in the back of the jail in the dark, because that's where the police had the police tape behind the jail. So even where they parked was speculative. You know, why would they park there? So they say once they got to the jail that although they had searched him twice, read his Miranda rights, and they found a dime bag of weed, that he was able to produce a gun. Now, he's handcuffed, Jim, not with the normal handcuffs you and I see with the little chain link where you might have a little mobility, but these were hinge handcuffs, some that I've never even seen before. It looked like door hinges. So your movement was very limited. You could very restricted. So how does a young man who's put in the back of a squad car, who's been searched twice, where they find a dime bag of weed, all of a sudden, although handcuffed in the backseat of a squad car, produce a gun and able to shoot himself in the chest? And that's a suicide? That dog don't hunt in any investigation, whether you're a cop or a journalist or just the what they ruled really insults the intelligence of every decent person in Louisiana. And what's happening in New Iberia puts a bad name on every good cop that's out there doing the right thing.
How old was Victor?
He was 21 years old. He was 21 years old. He was just shy of about a week or two, according to his father, of his 22nd birthday. What's ironic about this is he wanted to be a police officer. When you watch the film, Jim, and I suggest you watch it, it's going to humanize this young man. He grew up in his church. His dad was a pastor. He was a junior deacon. He was in the choir. He played musical instruments. He was a God-fearing child who had everything to live for. And in fact, he had called his father the night before, had gotten his income tax check, and had about, according to his father, $1,600 to $1,800 in his wallet, had told him he had found an apartment, and the next day he was going to put down his deposit on his apartment for him and his fiance, and that he had already found a car that he was going to buy that same week. So how does a kid who had everything to live for, was trying to get his life together, was bringing in a brand new child, his fiance was pregnant, how does a kid like that all of a sudden take his own life? And the word that the coroner uses, because the officer said that I'm gone, the word I'm gone. Tell my family I love them, I'm gone. And he shoots himself in the chest. Now, he shoots himself in the chest, and according to the testimony, Jim, their head is in the car. They're talking to him, trying to get him out of the car. So how can you be talking to a suspect, and then all of a sudden you hear a shot?
You don't see a kid who's handcuffed and able to retrieve a gun out of his behind and then shoot himself in the chest, which is physically impossible. So we got some problems down there.
All right. Well, where is your quest for justice going? What's the next step, Tony?
Well, the next step is going to obviously have to be for the people in New Iberia. I mean, the guy, if the federal government, Jim, couldn't get the guy, if the state, which we know that Lewis Ackle is a 25-year veteran of the state police. So the investigation from beginning to end was botched. The New Iberia Police Department lied. They actually went out to the scene and bagged the evidence and tagged his hands and everything. And they said that the state police had did it. So we found out in the court that they lied about that and handed over their evidence to the state police. And the state police ran with whatever they got because, mm-hmm. It's one of their guys. It's one of their own. So Alka was a 25-year, he retired as a captain in the Louisiana State Police. So how are you going to be allowed to investigate someone who you are a member of the same fraternity, someone who's worked for your organization for 25 years? I think they should have brought the feds in on this immediately. The state police should not have investigated that either, because they didn't do much of an investigation. They just took what they were given by the Iberia Parish Sheriff's Office and ran with it. So what we're hoping now is that what the Victor White case has done, Jim, I would say, that has been very beneficial to the community is we've gotten bad cops off the street, 10 of them. They will never work in law enforcement again. We also have people who are now confident enough to speak up about what's going on. We got rid of this gang that he had, this so-called interdiction team that was going into the neighborhood once a week, whether that was a crime or not, and just picking people up and taking them for a ride. And we know what that means. We also have at least almost 200 cases that were completely thrown out as a result of the arrest of these 10 bad, dirty cops. But the cop who taught them how to be dirty is still in office, and that's Lewis Ackle. And it's shameful. And it's shameful what's going on. And like I said, he gets a bad name to every good law-abiding cop here in the state of Louisiana.
If Sheriff Ackle desires to appear on this show at any time, we certainly welcome the opportunity to talk with him because you're leveling some pretty heavy allegations against him.
Well, all those allegations have been proven. These are not allegations. This is something that has documented court testimony from the federal court. Everything that I've given you has been said in a federal court, Jim. So these are not allegations. This is the truth. And this is coming out of the officers who worked with him, who worked for him. Everything I've told you is what they told the court and what they told the feds, and it's all documented public record.
Why do you think there's not enough of an outcry to force him from office if these allegations are true?
Fear. Fear. You know, the scripture tells us that, a ruler who lacks understanding is a great oppressor. You know, like a roaring lion and a charging bear, a wicked ruler he is over poor people.
All right, we do have to roll, but Tony Brown, it's always good to talk with you. Owner of a media outlet of renown, a station in Alexandria, and a journalist, as you can hear, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk with Sheriff Ackle. And we'll be back after this quick pause with another segment on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Adam Tooze is our guest. He's the author of The Deluge and The Wages of Destruction. He is the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Professor of History at Columbia University, where he directs the European Institute. And his book is a massive book about the national and world economy relating to the crash of 2008. The book is titled Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crisis Changed the World. We live in a world where dramatic shifts in the domestic and global economy command the headlines, but rollbacks in U.S. banking regulations to tariffs that may ignite international trade wars. But current events have deep roots, and the award-winning historian, Dr. Tooze, demonstrates the key to navigating today's roiling policies lies in the events that started it all, the 2008 economic crisis and its aftermath. Adam Tooze, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you think the repercussions are from 2008? I think most people would agree that we're still experiencing an effect, but you say it's quite dramatic.
Yes, I think you have to distinguish different levels. So in the US, I think at this point, one would really point to the politics as being the place where the aftershocks are felt most severely. In Europe, you'd probably say it was the actual economy. The European economy is still languishing. And if you pan back to take the global picture in view, then it's China that really dominates the entire story. The surge of the Chinese economy that powers its way through 2008 on a debt-fueled stimulus is really still with us. And the big question mark over the global economy today is whether that can possibly continue.
Many, as you note, may be unaware, or maybe we don't want to pay attention to it, but China, which is now, of course, in a trade war with us, is the holder of a big portion of the U.S. debt.
Yes, absolutely. And it has been since the early 2000s when it began to run large trade surpluses with the United States and invested those dollars in the treasuries being pumped out by the then Republican administration, which was fighting the war on terror and, of course, also pushing through major tax cuts at the same time. So big so-called twin deficits emerged, and China is key to that in absorbing America's treasuries and sending manufactured goods America's way.
What does that mean as far as China holding our debt? Does that mean the Chinese have significant power over our economy?
This is one of the fundamental questions of the of world history since the early 2000s. On the one level, you might say China then is America's creditor, and it's America's largest single creditor, and a creditor has power over a debtor. But as we all know, if you owe a bank $50,000, it's your problem. If you owe a bank $50 million, it's the bank's problem. In the case of the United States, Larry Summers talked about, in the case of the Chinese-American relationship, Larry Summers talked about a relationship, a balance of financial terror. So people began to think of this as being a little bit like the nuclear standoff of the Cold War period, because if China sells its debt, the American debt that it owns, it will suffer a huge loss on its existing stocks, and of course the dollar is likely to plunge, and the Chinese exports would suffer. And that's in the event that it in fact exerted any leverage at all. And there are plenty of people who will tell you that really this is an empty threat, not only because it might damage China, but because the global markets would happily absorb China's stock of treasuries, because they are, believe it or not, one of the safest things you can put your money in.
We're visiting with Columbia University professor Adam Tooze. His book is Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crisis Changed the World. And this is, to this point, the definitive book, I would say, on what's happened since 2008. Almost 700 pages, chock full of information. And you say, Dr. Tooze, that the financial meltdown of 2008 delivered the biggest shock to global trade ever recorded, that it was even worse than the Great Depression of 1929.
It is true, and it's a staggering fact that across the world, in virtually every commodity class, in every bilateral trading relationship you can look at in the global statistics, trade is falling in the winter of 2008. Never before had it fallen as fast, as rapidly as it was doing. And it isn't just volumes of trade which are collapsing, but of course commodity prices are collapsing too, whether you're talking about ag, whether you're talking about oil prices. They plunge from very high levels, I'm sure you remember, in early 2008, which was a global boom for agriculture and commodity producers, to very low levels by 2009, from which they then slowly clawed their way back. But this is a tremendous shock to exporting communities around the world.
You say the Federal Reserve turned itself into a global lender of last resort, and you believe the Obama administration was indispensable in turning things around. How and why?
So the Federal Reserve really steps into the role of the provider of dollars to the global banking system. I mean, the global banking system runs on dollars. This is its basic ingredient. And in a normal situation, that's fine, because dollars are super abundant. You can borrow them from non-American banks. You can borrow them from American banks. What was happening in 2008 was a global bank run. Everyone wanted their cash. Everyone wanted to be liquid. And you cannot, in any banking system, however solvent, sustain a situation where everyone wants to be liquid at the same time. Everyone wants the cash at the same time. Now, that's what we have central banks for. What we discovered in 2008 was that since the global economy ran on dollars, Federal Reserve had to be that lender of last resort to the global banking system. Above all, that meant to the European banks. What I do say, and President Obama used the phrase in the campaign of 2012, that America is the indispensable nation. In terms of crisis fighting in 2008-09, I think one should give credit where credit is due, if that's the right word, because it's obviously a very dirty business to have to be doing. But it was the Bush administration, Treasury Secretary Paulson, Bernanke, a Bush appointee at the Federal Reserve, and then Tim Geithner, who shuffles from the New York Fed into Treasury under Obama, that are responsible for this. So at the level of decision-making, this is really a bipartisan activity. What carries it in Congress is the Democratic Party's majority in Congress.
We are following the Russians a lot these days. Did they benefit from this crisis?
Not in a direct sense. The Russians are one of the world's largest oil and gas exporters. They suffer a hit along with everyone else. They owed the recovery of Russia from the crisis situation of the late 1990s to that commodity boom, so they're very badly hit. Putin's regime goes from being a feel-good kind of authoritarian regime to something rather tougher in its outlook, and all the more dependent on nationalism as slogans. But power is a relative thing, and as much as Russia suffered, the East European states, its former satellites around the edge of Russia, are hit even worse, and they have far fewer resources to cope. So if you want to understand the shifting balance of power in Eastern Europe, which has been such a pronounced feature of the last 10 years, and the recovery of Russia as one of the great powers of that region, then it's as much as it were that relative shift, the fact that places like Georgia, Ukraine suffer even worse than Russia, that creates the conditions in which that shift in the balance of power could take place.
As far as what's going on right now with China, the so-called trade war, what implications does this have?
Well, they're potentially, I think, very serious. Not if you like, they don't promise an implosion of the American economy. As important as Sino-American trade is, it's a small fraction of the U.S. economy. But for key constituencies, whether it's in agriculture, if you think about soy farmers, or whether you think about the American auto industry, GM sells more cars in China than it does in the United States, or if you think about tech companies like Apple, whose entire manufacturing operation for iPhones is in China and centers on China, for all of them, this is a potentially a huge disruption to what they took for granted as the horizon of economic growth. China accounts right now for 30% of global growth. That's as much as the United States and Europe put together. So if America uncouples from that in any way, it's a huge hit to the prospects of American business.
All right. A listener, Tracy, asked how much did the Fed outsource as far as the money that went in credit to European and in some cases, Asian central banks.
It's spectacular. And we know about it really because of obligatory requirements on the part of the Fed to disclose the scale of its activities. This was not something that they eagerly publicized. The total figure standardized to a 28-day loan period is $4.5 trillion, of which the majority went to the ECB, then the Bank of Japan, Bank of England, Swiss National Bank. And these were dollars provided against collateral, so the Fed will insist, and quite rightly, this was basically bomb-proof, zero risk. They charged essentially a commission on the loans that they provided. But what they were doing was opening a supply line of dollars to the global economy from October 13th, 2008. They are uncapped swap lines, so an unlimited amount of dollars can be produced for the needs of global banking. Why? Because otherwise what they feared was a fire sale. What they feared was that European and Asian banks would offload their dollar assets and massively destabilize American financial markets in doing so.
$4.5 trillion, though, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. It is indeed, but as we know, the volume of of global finance is massive. The balance sheets of individual banks in the world economy at this point are in the trillion-dollar scale. So viewed from that point of view, this is breaking the spikes, right? This is an effort on the part of the Fed to calm markets by providing a lender of last resort if there is no private credit available. And that's what they're doing systematically. That's a figure also aggregated over the period of the crisis from 2007 to 2009. But undeniably, it's a huge amount of money.
The book is Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crisis Changed the World, from Dr. Adam Tooze of Columbia University. Thank you, Professor, for joining us today, and congrats on your massive and important work.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned.